My name is Mark. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning, continuing our journey through the book of Micah and seeking to answer the question of who needs Christmas. And I'm going to start in an unconventional way this morning. I've been in church most of my life, and I don't think anybody has ever opened a sermon with a timeline. But that is how we're going to start this morning. So I'm going to ask, you may need some eagle eyes to see the print. I'm sorry about that. But to get a handle on our question this morning, it's going to be really important for us to get context. We're going to have to really understand that Micah is a real person writing at a real time in history about real events to real people. And I hope you can just about make out the bars at the top of the screen. That is just depicting the history books of the Bible that cover this period of time. It's 1 and 2 Chronicles and 1 and 2 Kings, and they start, or the meat of those the meat of those books starts at around 1000 BC, sort of at the almost at the height of the Israelite kingdom under David, and the kingdom is united for a while. And the story of Chronicles and Kings is really sort of a decline from that peak, and it ends, those books end more or less in the mid-500s BC with the completion of the decimation of that kingdom. The rot had set in relatively early. The United Kingdom split into two kingdoms around 930-odd BC, into the Northern Kingdom, which had the majority of the tribes of Israel, headquartered in Samaria, capitaled in Samaria, and the southern tribes capitaled in Jerusalem. And so you may recall from our very first week, Micah is speaking to a prophecy to Samaria and Jerusalem. He's speaking into this. You probably can't see exactly where Micah is on that timeline, but it's the second sort of little explosion. He's writing around 700 BC. And around that time, the Assyrians came and they decimated the northern kingdom. They laid it to waste and laid waste to most of the southern kingdom as well. Jerusalem itself managed to survive a short while longer, but the Babylonians came in just after the 600s BC, late 500s, and completed the job. And that was the end of the kingdom. The people were taken off into captivity. A few dribbled back a bit later, but it was sort of the end of the greatness of the kingdom. And then you can see on the far right-hand side, Christmas, the division of history at BC and AD, when Jesus was born around 4 to 6 BC. And why is this important? It's important because we need to understand that we're talking about real events that really happened and really came true. And from our perspective, we're standing way on the other side of the timeline, looking back over history, looking back to see what it is that happened. And so Micah is going to help us understand those events in far more color and clarity today as we start to delve into it. And as we look into this passage, I believe we're going to find three answers to our question of who needs Christmas. And they are: a waiting people need Christmas, a restless people need Christmas, and an impure people need Christmas. Maybe just starting with the first one, if we are to understand who needs Christmas, we need to understand what Christmas is. And to understand what Christmas is, we need to understand who Jesus is. And it's very easy, seemingly, in today's culture to not get who Jesus is. And I've got an example here from a well-known book of a few years back, maybe a good number of years back, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, written by Douglas Adams. And there Jesus is described as one man who had been nailed to a cross for saying how great it would be to be nice to people for a change. Now, that may well be a popular conception of what Jesus is like, but let me suggest if that is all who Jesus is, if he's just some guy who had some nice platitudes and who then died, then that's not reason for celebration at all. In fact, we would have ended our series in the first week after about 5 minutes of who needs Jesus? Who needs Christmas? Well, let me say, if you look back over history, nobody needs just another nice guy who died. History is full of people like that. What history needs is a much greater person, someone who spans history, a king, a ruler, who can put an end to the misery that we'll see as we look back over the corridors of history. And so how does Micah help us understand this promised king that we've been building up to over the few weeks, the weeks that we've been in here? Well, if we start in verse 2, we can see that Micah starts speaking into this situation, this dire situation that the Israelite nation has found themselves in, with the Assyrians camped on their doorstep, about to bring God's judgment for the dire sins they've committed. Pete shared with us in week 1 when we started that an example of just how far the nation had slid was that they were sacrificing their own children to the local deities, burning them alive in fire as a sacrifice to the local gods. And instead of being the light to the world that they were supposed to be, they'd become just like the rest, indistinguishable from the nations around them. And so Micah starts speaking a word of hope into this, and he says in verse 2, "But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins from of old, from ancient times." He starts speaking about God's ruler. This is somebody who will come and rule for God, and he's going to stand in stark contrast to sort of the crummy, evil, depraved kings that Israel has had before. If you go back and survey through Chronicles and Kings, there'll be a repeated narrative. So-and-so became king, and he did evil. So-and-so became king and did not follow God's ways. There are a few notable exceptions, but by and large, that is the trajectory. But here we see a king promised, a ruler promised, that is going to stand in stark contrast. In verse 4, there's some color on this. "He shall stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord and in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And they shall dwell secure, for now he shall be great to the ends of the earth." Not just some guy who died, who was nailed to a tree for saying nice things, but a ruler that is great to the ends of the earth. This is the promise that Micah starts to speak of. But bizarrely, this ruler is not going to come from a great center of learning or a center of power at that time. It's going to come from a tiny little smudge on the map. "Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come." It's going to be a surprising birthplace of this king, of this ruler. It's not going to be where people expect it to come from. It's going to be from a place of God's choosing. And it's going to be at a place, at a time of God's choosing. We read in verse 3, "Therefore he shall give them up until the time when she who is in labor gives birth. Then the rest of his brothers shall return to the people of Israel." Some translations render that first line that Israel will be abandoned. They'll be set aside by God as a result of their sin. They will have to wait for this deliverance to come through. And we see that happen. We'll come back to the timeline in a minute. So Micah is standing there looking forward to the coming of this new ruler. Micah, along with all those other prophets that we spoke about that you may have seen on the timeline, Isaiah, Jeremiah, they're all standing there looking forward, speaking of deliverance from this dire situation. But now Micah also looks back in history. He says, "Who's this new ruler, whose origins are from of old and from of ancient times." And I'll bring us back to our timeline just to get some perspective on that, because you can see on that timeline there are going to be many prophets who are still coming, who's still going to speak about this coming king, this coming ruler, this coming good shepherd. But Micah also looks back to the people that have gone before him and have been telling the same story. Before Micah was Isaiah. Quint read a little bit from Isaiah this morning. Before Isaiah was Solomon and David, also speaking of the ruler to come. Before him was Moses. Before him was Abraham. And you can trace it all the way back, right to the fall, right to maybe the first or second page of your Bible, where God speaks and says that a seed will come who will crush the serpent's head. Jesus' birth in modern culture divides history. There's a division of history, A, D, B, C, at the birth of Jesus. But there's another division of history that we can look at. And that is the one that takes place on the first or second page of your Bible, where, as John Milton put it, paradise was lost. And whereas the Apostle Paul puts it, death came into the world. And even at that point, even at that lowest point, where the seeds for all the misery that we have seen over history were sown, God starts speaking this word of hope for the future. And so as Micah stands there in 700 BC, he speaks not just of what's coming in 700 years, but he spans the whole of history. From the whole of history, this promise has been coming. And you may have heard this, that in this sense, history is his story. It's the story of a people waiting for deliverance from their enemy of sin. Waiting, waiting, waiting. And Micah joins in this chorus, as you've seen, speaking of this coming ruler. But first there's going to be a period of abandonment. And you'll see there, I'll come back to it in a second, there are no prophets from the end of Malachi to the time of Jesus. 400 years of silence. So now what? Well, from our perspective in history, we know exactly what. We know exactly what happened. The devastation that Micah promised comes true. In verse 1, he says, "O muster your troops, O daughter of troops. A siege is laid against us. With a rod they will strike the judge of Israel, the rulers of Israel, on the cheek." It's a graphic depiction of what actually happened. The rulers of Israel were struck. They were taken off. They were killed, put in captivity. The kingdoms were decimated. And exactly as it said in verses 7 and 8, the people were dispersed. The remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many people. I won't read the whole verse. Verse 8 as well opens. And the remnant of Jacob shall be among the nations in the midst of many peoples. Speaking of exactly what happened to the nation of Israel at that point in time. And so as they're cast out, as God's judgment comes true, all these heaped promises sit there, waiting, waiting. The Assyrians come and lay waste, and the promise lies waiting. The Babylonians come, the promise lies waiting. The Persians come, the promise lies waiting. The Greeks come, the promise lies waiting. The Romans come, the promise lies waiting. Silence, people waiting. And then the New Testament opens, and it opens with in Matthew with a story of this birth in Bethlehem, of this woman in labor who is with child, who's going to give birth to child. And all of a sudden, stuff starts happening again. And we read in Matthew of the Magi, the wise men coming from the east, and they come to Herod and they ask, "Where will we find the King of the Jews?" And as we read that passage in Matthew, Herod knows exactly what to ask. He goes to the chief priests and he asks, "Where's the Christ going to come from?" He knows what to ask because he's been waiting. And the chief priests know exactly where to go. They go to the prophets and they go to Micah and they go to our very passage today and they say, "He will come from Bethlehem." They've been waiting. Jesus didn't just arrive out of nowhere. He's not just some guy that popped into history fortuitously. He was the long-awaited Messiah. Luke also recounts events around the birth of Jesus. And when Jesus is taken to the temple in Luke 2, they encounter two people, Simeon, who's there described as someone who was waiting for the consolation of Israel. The next person they count is Anna, a prophetess in the temple, and she goes and speaks of Jesus to those who were waiting for the restoration of Jerusalem. People were waiting. And so what can we conclude about this? We can conclude that Jesus, as I say, is not just some guy who was a nice guy who arrived in history, said some nice things, and died. That wouldn't be good news for anything. Rather, Jesus is the fulfillment of the prophecy. He is the long-awaited Messiah. And when he comes, when he arrives, he puts an end to that waiting and he demonstrates several things for us. The first thing that he demonstrates is history is not a collection of random events. It's not just happening. You are not just an unfortunate soundbite in history. History is superintended by a loving and caring and all-powerful and almighty God. Rather than just some guy with some nice words who died on a tree, what the world really needs, what we really need, is the superintendent king over history who calls the end from the beginning, who demonstrated in the birth of Jesus that he will say what he will say and he will do what he will do. He will bring his person out of the most unexpected place, out of a tiny little spot on the map, barely even a spot on the map in the Middle East. He brought forth his king who will be great in all the earth. And he brought him forth at his time, at just the right time. And so he puts an end, God puts an end to the waiting of the generations, of all of history. He puts a capstone on it. Now, you may say, well, that's all good for the Jews living however many long ago, but I'm not really waiting. You know, what am I waiting for? I'm not waiting for the Messiah. I don't even believe in the Messiah. And may I push gently on that and say that in a very profound respect, we're all actually waiting. We're all waiting to have the answers to the deepest questions and yearnings of our lives. Because the Bible doesn't describe Jesus as just some guy who arrived to prove that what has come. It describes Jesus as reconciling all things. On a cosmic level, I think I will defer to some song lyrics at this point to make the point. And I think providentially and fortunately for me, it's a song that was written several decades ago and has been redone several times. So I'm hoping that no matter how old you are, you've heard the song. I'm not going to sing it. As I read the lyrics, I'm going to try not to sing it. It's quite catchy, but it's called Higher Love. Originally by Steve Winwood and most recently by Kygo and Whitney Houston. But just reflect on these lyrics. Think about it. What a great way to start. That is exactly what we want to be doing. Thinking about it. Think about it. There must be a higher love down in the heart or hidden in the stars above. Without it, life is wasted time. Look inside your heart, I'll look inside mine. Worlds are turning and we're just hanging on, facing our fears and standing out there alone. A yearning, and it's real to me. There must be somebody who's feeling for me. And as I say, with the fulfillment of these promises, Christmas shows us that life is not just wasted time. We are not just biding our time. We're not alone. Someone is there feeling for you. God, who looks at his people in their dire, desperate state and says, I will give you a ruler, feels for us. But this answer stands in stark contrast to the prevailing culture of our time, to the prevailing thinking of our time. You may perhaps hold this view passively or actively, but it's perhaps common to just think of history and the universe as something that just is. It just is. It has no meaning and purpose. And it's relatively rare that you'll hear it articulated in that form. But thankfully for us, for the purposes of proving this point, it has been in several books. And I've got some quotes here. The first is from a book by David Christian. That's a surname, not a descriptor, as you'll come to see. David is an Australian professor and co-founder, along with Bill Gates, no less, the real Bill Gates, of something called the Big History Project, looking to give some rhyme or reason and explanation of the history of the world. And he writes a book called Origin Story to help us understand this. And this is what he says. Unlike many traditional origin stories, the modern origin story lacks a creator God. It's about a universe that just is. Any sense of meaning comes not from the universe, but from us. Just make it up as you go along. The very next paragraph, he quotes Joseph Campbell. Joseph Campbell is an American professor credited by George Lucas as being one of the inspiring factors in the Star Wars series. Joseph Campbell says this: what's the meaning of the universe? Well, what's the meaning of a flea? It's just there. That's it. And your own meaning? It's that you're here. The next quote is from Daniel Dennett, one of the four horsemen of New Atheism. In the beginning, there were no reasons. There were only causes. Nothing had a purpose. Nothing had so much as a function. There was nothing that had interests. There is nothing out there to care. Your life, in this frame of view, is meaningless. What is the meaning of a flea? Will you tell me, what is the meaning of a flea? Does it matter if a flea is squashed? Does it matter if a flea exists? It doesn't. And so the answer that secular humanism and atheism and the culture of our time must give to that question from higher love is that, well, yes, life is just wasted time. You are there alone and no one is feeling for you. There is no one to feel for you. No one is interested because no one has any interest. But at Christmas, as I say, we see a stark contrast to that. We see history having a purpose, having meaning, and God superintending over it, infusing it with meaning, and your life matters. So Christmas is for those who are waiting to connect with the real meaning of history, the real meaning of the universe, the real meaning of life. Our second point is that Christmas is for a restless people. I'm going to quote again from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams. This is in the same passage that I mentioned earlier. Speaking of Earth, this planet had a problem, which was this. Most of the people living on it were unhappy for pretty much all of the time. He then offers some solutions but concludes, the problem remained and lots of the people were mean and most of them were miserable, even the ones with digital watches. I mean, if that's not an indictment on our on the state of where we've come to, I don't know. That book was written, I think, in the late 70s or 80s, where digital watches, I guess, were a thing. But we can even stand here with our iWatches and our technology and feel quite pleased with ourselves. But really, have we actually moved the dial at all in terms of human happiness for all our development? You know, you may look at Micah in 700 and go, oh, those Stone Age guys, so unhappy, so dire. But really, have we moved much from there? And I suspect that as we look at history and as we look at our own times, we can see we're a restless people. Look at the mass migrations in South America, into Central America, Africa, Middle East, Europe, the bitter politics of the US and Brexit, the riots in Hong Kong, our own bitter politics. We're a people ill at ease. We're a restless people. I think, again, if I can rely on Kygo and Whitney Houston, another verse from that song. Things look so bad everywhere. In this whole world, what is fair? We walk the line and try to see, falling behind in what could be. We're groping around in the dark, restless, trying to find this meaning and purpose. And I doubt any of us could have been as restless as the people that Micah was writing to at this point in time. The Israelites sitting with the Assyrians on their doorstep must have been feeling pretty restless. It's a dark and dire time in their history. And the Assyrians are not to be messed with. Their army is about to be decimated. There's no Geneva Convention. There are no war crimes tribunals. It's going to be dead people and slaves, basically. That's it. Those who are lucky enough to remain will be carried off into a foreign land in captivity or left with a heap of stones in their own country. And yet it's into this mess that Micah speaks the surprising word of hope in verse 5. And he shall be their peace. When the Assyrian comes into our land, and then he goes on into this almost sort of victorious song, war cry of victory in the face of the Assyrians. And we must surely stand here and go from our point in history and go, well, how on earth did that work? How on earth could he be speaking a word of peace into this violence, into this restlessness? Well, the New Testament writer of Hebrews helps us understand what it is that they were looking forward to in a passage that's key to understanding Christmas. It's key to understanding the incarnation. Why did Jesus take on flesh? Why did Jesus come as a human being? Well, the writer in Hebrews says this: since the children, us people, have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity, so that by his death he might break the power of him who holds the power of death, that is, the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. Through Jesus, the sting of death is taken out. Death holds no more fear for those who will believe. And we might stand and go, okay, well, that's great for people who've come after Jesus, but how did those Old Testament guys get their head around it? Well, the writer in Hebrews continues, and in Hebrews 11 says this, illustrating what their mindset was, speaking about some of these Old Testament prophets. And these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. They saw them and welcomed them from a distance. I've just lost my place. Admitting that they were foreigners and strangers in the earth. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be their God. They were not looking for a physical victory. They were looking for a greater victory, a victory over their real enemy. And Micah here pictures the Assyrians as their real enemy, which is sin and death. Because the ruler that is of the caliber and the greatness of the ruler that Micah has spoken of is not someone who gives a peace that can just be taken away. It's not a peace that relies on things. It's not a peace that relies on walls. It's a peace that relies on being at peace with God. And that is why the writers of the New Testament can use exactly the same phrase that Micah uses when he describes this peace. Micah describes peace not as coming from something, but as being a person. He will be their peace. And Quint helped us understand this a few weeks ago when he spoke to us out of Ephesians, and he quoted from Paul where he writes in Ephesians 2:14, "For he himself is our peace." How is he our peace? He is our peace because he breaks down the hostility between us and God. You see, the Israelites' real problem was not the Assyrians. The Assyrians were God's instrument of judgment for their sin. Their real problem was their sin. And by dealing with their sin, by dealing with sin and death, Jesus brings peace. He brings peace to a restless people. This is perhaps best summed up by Augustine in his book Confessions, where he makes this observation: "You made us for yourself, and our heart is restless until it rests with you." Are you ill at ease? Are you lacking peace? Christmas is for you. Christmas is the birth of He who is our peace. And thirdly and finally, Christmas is for an impure people, because as we look back over history, not only do we see that it's filled with a restless people, but it's filled with people of impure hearts. Look back as far as you will in history and as wide as you will in history, you will find there's not a people, not a nation, not a gender, no one, no society that does not have blood on its hands. It's common in our politics these days to kind of paint the oppressed as the perpetual saint, the virtuous underclass being exploited. But unfortunately, history shows us that that simply is not the case. There isn't this saintly underclass of people. It doesn't matter whether you're oppressed. You are just as likely, once you come into power, to oppress as those who are already in oppression. And history abounds with those examples. the French Revolution with its famous virtues that it espoused, liberty, fraternity, equality, turned into what? The Reign of Terror. The people's revolutions of communist Russia and communist China and elsewhere. Tens of millions of people massacred, the very people that were supposed to be liberated. Our own history shows us that, and the history of our northern borders, how today's freedom fighter is tomorrow's oppressor. There is no part of history, no person, no people, no time that hasn't been stained by blood. And the Israelites are an archetypal example of this. Oppressed as slaves in Egypt, liberated by God, only to themselves become oppressors of their own people and the nations around them. And as we've been through Micah, we've been looking at this, we've examined this. In 2 Chronicles, the writer of Chronicles gives us God's perspective on what was going on. God looks at this mess that his people have fallen into, and he sends his messengers. This is 2 Chronicles 36. The Lord, the God of their ancestors, sent word to them through his messengers again and again. Why? Because he had pity on his people and on his dwelling place. God saw the mess that they were in, the embrace of idols, the comfort they had found, and he takes pity on them because it's a pitiful state. It's a pitiful state to be lost and alone in the world. But what was their response? But they mocked God's messengers, despised his words, and scoffed at his prophets, until the wrath of the Lord was aroused against his people, and there was no remedy. It may, as we look at history, seem brutal that the Assyrians came. But it was not without God's pity on his people that he looked at them and saw them lost, losing their way, clawing around in the dark. And God takes pity and he calls them again and again and again. And like every other people in history, they scoffed, they mocked, they went their own way. You see, the problem is not for us an economic system or a political system that we need to replace. The problem for us is our hearts. Our hearts are bent on these things. We don't want the life that God offers us. We don't want his pity. And so what we see in the closing passages, closing verses of this passage, is that in order to give his people peace, in order to give them what they want, what they need, God must do what they cannot do. He must do himself what the people cannot do, and that is rid themselves of idols, rid themselves of the sources of the hubris and the self-sufficiency that had led them so badly off course. And so he says in verses 10 and onwards, in that day, declares the Lord, I will cut off your horses from among you, and I will destroy your chariots. I will cut off the cities of your land and throw down all your strongholds. And I will cut off sorceries from your land, and you shall have no more tellers of fortunes. And I will cut off, and I will cut off your carved images and your pillars from among you, and you shall bow down no more to the work of your hands. I mean, how pitiful is that? How pitiful that the nation that had seen such great workings of God was bowing down to the works of their own hands. And I will root out your Asherah images from among you and destroy your cities. And in anger and wrath, I will execute vengeance on the nations that will not obey. In his pity, God looks at us and says, be rid of these things. Be rid of these things that you think will bring you meaning, will think will bring you purpose, you think will bring you peace, but in fact have done exactly the opposite for you. And as we stand here today, 2,000 years, more than 2,000, 2,800 years later, looking back at Micah's prophecy and these people, we may think that actually, oh, well, that's not us. But may I suggest that actually that's often us. we find our peace and our security in our cities, in our strongholds, in the work of our hands, in our money. And God is saying, that is not going to bring you peace. Be rid of it. Be done with it. It's pitiful. I offer you peace. I offer you peace in myself. Be done with all these other things. So how do we respond to these answers to who needs Christmas? Well, it seems to me as we look back through history and we see that the God who promised to do things actually did those things. That he did those things out of care and compassion for us. The only logical response is to believe the promises, is to believe that he will be our peace. Believe the promises. And if you have found yourself in one of those categories today, may I encourage you, believe the good news. Believe that peace has come. Believe that meaning has come. Believe that you have been reconciled. Believe that your heart will find rest when you come to the message of Christmas. Heed the warnings. Heed the warnings that God in his pity gives us to be done with the idols, to put them aside and to find real rest and real peace. And may I encourage you as we continue our journey as a church on this, lean in with us. We're here every week unpacking this, trying to see Jesus more clearly for who he really is. Not some guy who was nailed to the tree for saying some nice words, but the ruler that spans history, the king that stands above it all, and the king that promises us peace.